We have plenty. We have gathered into bars, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories.
I was born in Texas, 1853, a descendant of African, Native American, and Mexican ancestors. After the Civil War, I worked for the Freedmen's Bureau. I have fought against injustices of poverty, racism, capitalism, and the state for my entire life. My name is Lucy Parsons.
That's Tanya Hutchins from the Machinists Union. She'll be one of the performers, and we were there this Wednesday night when the Coalition of Labor Union Women celebrates its 47th anniversary with an online performance of this play, which features inspiring women leaders from the past through the present. To register for this free show, Wednesday, March 24th at 7 p.m., go to dclabor.org and click on calendar.
The popularity of Pins and Needles made it one of Harold Rome's longest-running shows. He often said its success was due to the relatability of the cast. Actual garment workers, as the cast created a rapport and sense of identification with audiences.
Library of Congress archive processing technician Melissa Capozzo-Jones explores Pins and Needles, the only Broadway hit musical revue ever produced by a labor union, with a cast of union members singing about unions.
I think the lasting and shameful legacy of this period is that we took the position that industry was more important than people, was more important to keep the crop going, to favor the growers.
Labor History Today producer Patrick Dixon talks with author Mark Torres about his forthcoming book, Long Island Migrant Labor Camps, Dust for Blood. And on today's Labor History in Two...
The year was 1947. That was the day President Harry S. Truman signed Executive Order 9835. It is commonly referred to as the Loyalty Order.
I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Hope you enjoy it. Here's the show.
And came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line. We raised our voices.
I was born in Texas, 1853, a descendant of African, Native American, and Mexican ancestors. After the Civil War, I worked for the Freedmen's Bureau. I have fought against injustices of poverty, racism, capitalism, and the state for my entire life. My name is Lucy Parsons. I was forced to move to Chicago with my husband, Albert, in 1873 because he was a white man. There were laws against intermarriage in the South, and he had been registering black people to vote. In Chicago, I began organizing sewing workers and led thousands of them out on strike on May 2, 1886, as part of the nationwide protest for an eight-hour day. My husband was one of the founding members of the Chicago Trades and Labor Assembly. On May 4, 1886, he spoke at a demonstration in Haymarket Square, sanctioned by the mayor of Chicago, protesting police attacks on the eight-hour day demonstration the day before. After we left the demonstration, a bomb went off, and Albert was eventually imprisoned and hanged, along with four other men accused of the bombing. When I begged to see him on his last morning, the police strip-searched me and my children and threw us naked into a jail cell. They let us go once he was dead. A few years later, the governor pardoned everyone else who was charged for the bombing for lack of evidence. I made my living as a dressmaker to support my two children and continued speaking out. The Chicago police characterized me as more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. I, along with Mother Jones, was one of the founding members of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, commonly known as the Wobblies. Never be deceived that the rich will permit you to vote away their wealth. We, the women of the country, have no ballot even if we wish to use it. And the only way that we can be represented is to take a man to represent us. You men have made such a mess of it in representing us that we have not much confidence in asking you. We are the slaves of slaves. We are exploited more ruthlessly than men. Whenever wages are to be reduced, the capitalist class use women to reduce them. And if there is anything that you men should do in the future, it is to organize the women.
Tanya Hutchins from the Machinists Union. She'll be one of the performers, and we were there this Wednesday night when the Coalition of Labor Union Women celebrates its 47th anniversary with an online performance of this play, which features inspiring women leaders from the past through the present. To register for this free show, Wednesday, March 24th at 7 p.m., go to dclabor.org and click on calendar.
Battle is won, but the fight's just begun, and the Union flag's unfurled. United we're strong, let us march toward the dawn of a brave new workers' world. Oh, Union of the garment workers, to you we ever will be true. We'll build and we'll fight and we'll rise in our might with the ILGWU. North, south, east and west, all the workers oppressed, join the Union ranks today. Our banners are bright as they float red and white where our Union leads the way. Oh, Union of the garment workers, to you we ever will be true. We'll build and we'll fight and we'll rise in our might with the ILGWU. With the ILGWU.
That was Joe Glazer, Labor's troubadour, singing the anthem of the ILGWU, the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union. Earlier this year, we came across a post on the Library of Congress In the Muse Performing Arts blog. In Sing Me a Song with Social Significance, Harold Rome and the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, archive processing technician Melissa Capozio-Jones explores Pins and Needles, the only Broadway hit musical revue ever produced by a labor union with a cast of union members singing about unions. Here's Melissa.
About a decade before the golden age of American musical theater, with shows like Oklahoma and Annie Get Your Gun, there was a long-running musical revue with a very unusual cast and a rather unassuming title, Pins and Needles. For those unfamiliar with the show, the name might evoke thoughts of an arm or a leg falling asleep and the associated tingling sensation. As of yet, we don't know of any musical devoted entirely to one's foot falling asleep. Instead, Pins and Needles derives its title from the unconventional circumstances of its creation, thanks to the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, or the ILGWU. The ILGWU was at one time the largest labor union in the United States. In the 1920s and 30s, they were headquartered in New York City and used the Princess Theater just off of 6th Avenue as a regular meeting hall. At this time, the union had a designated cultural division, whose purpose was to provide lessons in singing, dancing, playing musical instruments like the mandolin, and other artistic pursuits to members of the union and their families. The Princess Theater, or Labor Stage as it was eventually called, became not only a meeting venue but a recreation hall, providing a place for the cultural division to showcase the union members' talents and newfound artistic skills. Sensing a perfect opportunity, the director of the cultural division at the time, Louis Schaefer, requested that the board sponsor a low-budget musical revue at the theater. The board was quite obstinate about the idea, so Schaefer went and hired a professional theater troupe and writers to create a sort of mock show. The show was performed for the board, and they were eventually persuaded and agreed to produce the musical revue. So Schaefer, with the support of the board, hired lyricist and songwriter Harold Rome to write the music for the revue. This would be Rome's first foray into Broadway, and it would become his first official Broadway score and one of his most successful. Pins and Needles was originally conceived as a small theatrical production, functioning as entertainment for and by the union members. And unlike a show with professional actors and singers, work on Pins and Needles was restricted by the schedule of the factory and garment trade workers who made up the cast. Rehearsals were held at night, and the initial performances were given only on Friday and Saturday evenings. This ensured that the sewing machine operators, basters, and cutters in the cast could keep their jobs while continuing to participate in the review. With the show's eventual and explosive success, the cast left their factory jobs to rehearse and perform the show full-time. Performances were expanded to 8 shows a week. They actually had to move the entire production to the Windsor Theater in 1939. Pins and Needles saw a total of 1,108 performances over its 3-year run from 1937 until 1940, and was hailed as a Broadway smash. And at the height of its popularity, it was even performed at the White House for FDR and the First Lady. But what made it so popular? Well, with a union sponsor and a cast of union workers, Rome's Revue was pro-union, topically relevant, and politically charged. It included a skit in which Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler explained their wartime decisions, titled Four Little Angels of Peace. There was a song poking fun at Herbert Hoover, titled, originally, When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a G-Man. And in keeping with the pro-union theme, a love song sweetly titled One Big Union for Two.
I've decided the only way I can woo you is to take a hint from the AFL and the CIO.
Now you're talking, perhaps I might listen to you. I don't say that I'll say yes, but I don't say I'll say no.
Then it's not too late to negotiate.
Oh, well, we'll see.
Perhaps we can agree. I'm on a campaign to make you mine. I'll picket you until you sign in one big union for two. No court's injunction can make me stop until your love is all closed shop in one big union for two. 7 days a week I want the right to call you mine both day and night. The hours may be long, but 50 million union members can't be wrong.
When we have joined up, perhaps there'll be a new recruit or two or three.
For that's what teamwork can do.
Have sit downs inside our gate. We'll never need to arbitrate in one big union for two.
We'll have no lockouts to make us frown, no scabbing when I'm out of town in one big union for two.
Will you pay your dues? They're very light. A kiss each day and a kiss each night. Our life will be a song.
For 50 million union members can't be wrong. When we have signed up and made the grade, we'll add a member.
Union made who looks like me and like you.
Of all the songs in the show, though, Rome considered Sing Me a Song with Social Significance to be the most important and the main theme. He once admitted that the hit song came to him while he was in the shower. He claims to have jumped out soaking wet and completely naked to jot the tune down before drying off and getting dressed.
I
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
The songs and skits in the review changed regularly throughout its 3-year run in order to keep the social commentary topical. But according to reviews, the show never ran low on entertainment and satirical wit. Even with its surprising fame, the review was not immune to criticism and concerns. When the show was set to open in Providence, Rhode Island, in late 1940, the Providence Bureau of Police and Fire banned the performance unless a scene that satirized a pro-fascist Catholic priest, a German-American Nazi organization leader, and a North Carolina senator was cut from the show. The scene was eventually removed, but not without extreme protest from the cast and production staff. The timeless appeal of satirical social commentary and Rome's score has ensured that this show has lived on in new productions over the decades. Pins and Needles saw its largest off-Broadway revival in 1978 and was performed for the very first time in the United Kingdom in 2010. The show even received a slight update in 2011 when it was performed by the social justice organization FURY, Families United for Racial and Economic Equality. In keeping with the tradition of the original production, the cast was made up entirely of organization members. They performed 10 of Rome's original songs, while also incorporating songs from two prominent black songwriters of the early 20th century, Josh White and Leadbelly. The addition of their music helped the review explore the African-American experience, which had not been part of the original 1937 production.
I'm not doing it.
What's going on?
90 looms, I can't do it.
Well, those are the orders I got. If you can't film them,
I guess you... I began to work in this mill when I was 8 years old. I didn't get a cent the first month. Then I got 15 cents a day. Then I worked my way up till I became an experienced weaver, $19 a week. But now, you cut my salary and double my work, I can't do it.
You mean you won't do it?
That's right. I won't do it. And none of the other union men would either.
The performance also included new numbers that dealt with current events, such as the anti-union legislation that was signed into law in Wisconsin in early 2011, and the passage of the Domestic Workers' Bill of Rights. The popularity of Pins and Needles made it one of Harold Rome's longest-running shows. He often said its success was due to the relatability of the cast. Actual garment workers, as the cast created a rapport and sense of identification with audiences. One could also say that without the entertaining and witty music and lyrics by Rome himself, the show might have never gotten off the ground long enough to gain an audience. Either way, Pins and Needles remains the only Broadway hit musical revue ever mounted by a labor union, with a cast of union members singing about unions, and it became the longest-running show of the 1930s.
Library of Congress archive processing technician Melissa Capozio Jones reading her post, "Sing Me a Song with Social Significance, Harold Rome and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union," on the Library of Congress In the Muse Performing Arts blog. Check out their latest posts at blogs.loc.gov/music. Here's another song from Pins and Needles. This is Barbra Streisand singing Doing the Reactionary.
It's darker than the dark bottom. It rumbles more than the rumba. If you think that the two-step got 'em, just take a look at this number. It's got that certain swing that makes you wanna sing. Don't go left, but be polite. Move to the right, doing the reactionary. Close your eyes to where you're bound, and you'll be found doing the reactionary. All the best dictators do it. Millionaires keep stepping to it. The 400 love to sing it. Ford and Morgan swing it. Hand up high and shake your head. You'll soon see red doing the reactionary.
Don't go left, but be polite. Move to the right,
doing the reactionary.
Close your eyes to where you're bound, and you'll be found
doing the reactionary.
All the best dictators do it. Millionaires keep stepping to it. The 400 love to sing it.
Ford and Morgan swing it. Hand up high
and shake your head. You'll soon see red
doing the react,
doing the react.
Mark, thanks for joining us on Labour History Today. I'm excited to talk to you about your new book, Long Island Migrant Labour Camps, Dust for Blood. And there have been a number of histories in the past about migrant labourers, often in California or the southern United States. But among the things that stood out for me was the geographical focus on your study. People don't often associate agricultural work with this part of the world. So I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about what drew you to the subject and what you felt made Long Island in particular an interesting area to study.
Sure. And similar to you, I'm keenly aware of the farm workers and the treatment of farm workers throughout the country. And there's always been whispers or kind of low talks about the county and the high agricultural output and the workers there, but nothing was really done. There have been newspaper articles, two very rare documentaries, but nothing on a scale that would be considered a primary source. First and foremost, my goal was to capture that history and chronicle it for the world. It's very important. And Long Island is an interesting thing. We're talking 80, 90 miles from New York City, the hub of the world in many ways. And most people don't realize is the incredible agricultural output that was produced, particularly on the east end of Long Island, Suffolk County. And primarily that was potatoes. You know, Suffolk County was a very heavy producer and supplier of potatoes. They were one of the top counties in the country at the time, right up to shortly after or during World War II. And for many years, there was a lot that goes with that. Obviously, it's a very labor intensive, and they needed, the farmers and growers needed ample labor to retrieve these crops and harvest these crops. And there was a heavy shortage. And that led into the elements in the book, which were filled by migrant workers who came year after year to harvest and work on these farms.
I'm sure there's not a beginning date of people farming there, but you mentioned that the labor camps specifically are established in the 1940s. Can you describe the circumstances in which this came about? Was it to do with World War II?
Yes, absolutely. For 1943, in a small hamlet of Peconic, which is in the township of Southold on the east end of Long Island, was the first recorded labor camp that I was able to discover. It was at a facility called Lake Lodge. It was this three-story cottage home and its surrounding area that was used to house approximately 100 migrant workers from the island of Jamaica. And interestingly enough, that was under a contract with the United States government. In fact, there were a total of about 400 workers at four different camps that came up right after the opening of Lake Lodge. So the target date specific is unique because that was the first recorded camp where workers would be housed. And admittedly, because they were under government contract, the conditions at these camps were far better than what would have been shown and seen in the subsequent years.
And what were you able to find out about these guys who were working there? What sort of resources were there available?
Sure. They were housed at the facility and the surrounding areas. They would construct these facilities for them to live in a typical mess hall type setting where the sleeping facility would be called, they call it the bullpen. It was just basically one large room or hall where a bunch of bunk beds would be laid out. This provided sleeping facilities. Certainly there was no privacy. There was always concerns of certainly in later years, there was always concerns of security and treatment of these workers. But those initial years, that was the setting at these camps, generally in that open area. They worked on nearby farms. They were brought in, and from what my research shows, they came, again, the U.S. government sponsored it. It was estimated to be $100 per person, the travel cost. And the workers came from Jamaica through New Orleans in Louisiana, and they took the train all the way to Long Island. And when they got there, like I said, the early records, and it was short-lived. The program probably lasted 4 years till 1947 or so, a couple of years. And from what all reports that I was able to find, the treatment was fair, the conditions at the camp were fair, and largely because, again, this was a government-sponsored camp that likely had more oversight than would in subsequent years.
So that program lasts until 47, but the camps remain. How does it change after that?
They grew exponentially. I could tell you in 1951, there was 29 registered camps in the county. 8 years later, by 1958, there were 134 camps.
Wow.
Housing thousands of workers. And in size and scope, Suffolk County is not that large. It's probably two-thirds of the Long Island itself. But that was a lot of camps. And those are the registered ones. There likely were unregistered ones. If a camp had less than five workers, they technically would have been a camp, but if they were less than a certain amount, they would not fall under the requirements to register. So that number ballooned tremendously, and as the camps went on and the methods evolved, conditions grew worse, and there was less oversight, and it became a lot more of an industry, if you will, where certainly it was valued a lot more than the workers that were there.
And are they still attracting folks from Jamaica, or are they different streams of migrant labor at that point?
Yeah, definitely the streams changed. Initially, it was from Jamaican Barbados. There were also some workers from Mexico and Puerto Rico. And then later on, Puerto Rican workers were still used under contract. Now, those workers received far better benefits and conditions of employment, almost akin to being part of a labor union. They were negotiated contracts. But in Suffolk County, the numbers of the contract Puerto Rican workers were very minimal, probably in a couple of hundreds. And the bulk of the work, the bulk of the workforce came from the South. Black workers from the U.S. southern states primarily filled almost nearly all of the workforce at that time.
And among the episodes you describe in the book is there's a terrible fire that takes place in October 1961. But you also mentioned this wasn't the only fire that took place. Can you share a little bit about some of the dangers that these farm workers experienced farming potatoes, of all things?
Aside from the work always being hazardous and conditions extreme and even exposure to pesticides and whatnot, the conditions at the camp were, the camps were always generally in disrepair, not fireproof, shoddy, hazardous, rife with crime and violence. So the setting was certainly just dismal, to say the least. The 1961 fire at Cutthroat Labor Camp was at the time the largest camp in New York State, certainly in Suffolk County. It could hold as many as 300 workers in the harvest season, which is a lot, very large, and if you think about the area we're discussing. That camp was 1961. Three workers died on the scene. One of them died later at the hospital. Because these workers came from the south in the colder weather, they naturally were looking for heat and warmth. And they resorted to using these portable kerosene heaters and cooking stoves. Mm-hmm. Now, conditions, which I can discuss shortly after about the economic exploitation, they were such that these workers couldn't afford the meals or the cost of the meals at the camp, which at the time were probably 75 cents. So these workers virtually snuck in a portable cooking stove, used it, and afterwards when they went to sleep, the fire erupted, and within minutes, the whole barracks were erupted. It's quite frankly surprising not many more people were injured. And one of them actually reportedly was outside. He did make it out, but because he had a new pair of shoes, he ran back in to retrieve his shoes, was overcome by the smoke, and he died. Now, that fire drew a lot of notoriety in the press at the time. But there were several fires before that. I can go back to 1950 in Bridgehampton, which is on the southern tip of Long Island, Southern Fork. Two babies burned in a makeshift shack the family was living at in a fire. Same reasons, a portable kerosene heater. Several fires continued throughout. In fact, in 1959, in the town of Riverhead, there was 8 deaths in 11-day span, and that included very young children and adults, male and female alike. So the conditions were such that people either had to take matters into their own hands, whether it's shortcuts with their safety, because these kerosene heaters and stoves were at the time banned, but they still resorted to finding ways to get them, use them, and sadly perish from them. And subsequent years after the 1961 fire, there was a 1968 fire in Bridgehampton and several others throughout. But again, for the same traumatic reasons, people really risked their lives trying to take these shortcuts, or out of dire need and extreme poverty, searching for warmth and food, perished.
Mm. And you mentioned there's a lot of crime and violence. What are we talking about here? Is this on the part of employers towards workers, or is this workers exploiting one another?
It was actually a lot of both. And maybe it would help at this point to explain the economic system of this migratory labor that was used in Suffolk County. So after the move from the government-sponsored contracts, the growers would get together, form corporations, and actually construct or build or buy these labor camps. They would then contract with what's called crew leaders. And these crew leaders would go to the farm, to these growers, and say, look, I'll get the labor for you for a certain amount per person. And they would work out this contractual arrangement. These crew leaders would go back to these states in Arkansas, Florida, Carolinas, and they would recruit these workers, promising them fair living, fair wages, good living conditions, all of the things that would turn out to be quite illusory. And were able to bring them back. A lot of them had buses and trailers and large cars, and they would bring these porters. And the minute they stepped onto these vehicles, the workers were already indebted to them for the ride both there and back home at the end of the season. So the whole system is rife with kind of chasing that. You're already in debt. Things are purchased on credit or high markups. A bottle of alcohol, for instance, would cost 61 cents in the store, and they would sell it at $1.25, and again, all purchased on credit. So the debt contingency is perpetual, and the workers are working throughout the season to catch up. Now, because the workers came from different areas, there was no natural cohesive relationship. People from different backgrounds don't always get along, and that certainly happened here, particularly on in and around payday, which is typically Saturday night. There would be gambling, drinking, and of course, unfortunately, events could lead to turn for worse, whether it's fighting or stealing, theft. There were certainly many crimes of beating, stabbings, and of course, murder. I recall one character. His name was an actual blues artist. His name was Son House, S-O-N, and then House. That was his stage name. When he was at a camp in 1955 in Cutchon, got into a dispute with another camp, the person at the camp, stabbed him to death. He was caught, put on trial, went to jail for an undetermined amount of time. Within 10 years later, he resumed his career and pretty much finished his career and continued on till his retirement and subsequent death. And he was a well-known blues artist named Son House. Those are the type of it was a breeding ground for crime, violence, both sexual and physical abuse, all types. People would come, illicit liquor dealers, and they would come and peddle alcohol on the on the grounds. And a lot of the workers were isolated. The camps were always in an isolated location, so they were prone to these types of vices, sadly, which led to high alcohol rate and all of these criminal and psychological effects that plagued them throughout.
I guess they didn't get a union, but did workers manage to organize to improve their conditions at all?
Sadly, no. The federal law, which is still the case now, the National Labor Relations Act excludes farm workers from that federal labor law protection. There are some state laws in California in the 70s, but in New York, there wasn't a New York state labor law until this year that actually passed that offers better protections and rights. Sadly, that's still being challenged by some farmer organizations. It was divide and conquer. There was little, the crew leaders played on the vices. They controlled the workers with alcohol, with sending them to work or not sending them to work and cheating them out of pay. And this exploitation was rampant and chronic. I do recall in 1947 at a camp in Greenport, there was approximately 200 workers from Mexico who protested the wages they were getting. At the time, it was 60 cents an hour, which generally was on par for that time. They felt they should have been paid 5, 10 cents more per hour. So they actually walked off the job for a day. They had a hearing, an emergency hearing at a nearby high school. There was no one to represent the workers, sadly. And the Farm Association heard the growers' position and ruled immediately that they were being paid correct and the workers went back to work the next day. That was probably the most amazing and short-lived, unfortunately, example of workers getting together for the common good. Because again, it was this divide and conquer mentality, and there was little chance for organization. And also, I'll add, there was little chance of getting any public sympathy. A lot of the local public, people in the area, you certainly detested these camps and the people who lived in it. They associated them with crime, and then there was racism and a lot of bad points. So there was little help that they were going to get from the public to make conditions better. The only advocacy, and I shouldn't say only, because there was a great level, were local clergy, local people who jumped in, and years later, a group, for instance, the Eastern Farm Workers Association, which was like a labor union, although they weren't, they were just a group that was a membership organization where people joined at very low dues, and they got together again to try to address the common goods and needs that they would have to strive for.
So does this system wind up at a certain point, or are there still migrant laborers traveling to Long Island to work in migrant camps to this day?
The system that I highlight in the book, by and large, is no longer in effect. However, there are still, because now those old potato farms are now replaced with vineyards and the vast fields and still some fruit farming. And for many reasons, things are different than they were. The regulations are much stronger. There is a lot more affordable housing for a lot of people who don't have to come and go. They could stay in the area and work longer in those areas. So the era of the camps, which I define in my book, is a bygone era, and it generally I run it through to the year 2000, and really sadly that demise of that era didn't come from any humanitarian hope and kind of relief. It came because of the changing in the farming structure. More machines were used, less workers were needed, hence less camps were utilized. And so other reasons, increased land value, there are several other factors, and just the change in generational farming that people just, a lot of farmers just cashed out. They sold their farms, said we're done, and there's not enough money to be made, and they moved on. So for those reasons, sadly, that the labor camp era that I define in my book, by and large, came to an end. There are some camps now, but again, vastly different than the camps I've highlighted in my book.
When you look at this country today, we have worker crises of all sorts all over the place, and it's often difficult for farm workers to be included in the conversation. They're historically underrepresented, and it seems some people would rather forget about them. But when you consider your study of Long Island, what lessons do you think from history that we can draw from that are most important when we think about the problems of farm workers today?
Sadly, I can say past this prologue, and the workers today are treated just as bad, although slightly different than they were then. Obviously, with the COVID pandemic, we see in Southern Jersey half the workforce has the virus. There was legislation in the prior presidential administration that sought to pay them less. Discrimination is still ongoing. The federal law still doesn't include them. So by and large, the elements are still the same. But I think the the lasting and shameful legacy of this period in this location is that we took the position, and I say we because everyone's involved, that industry was more important than people. And that's a sad legacy because it was more important to keep the crop going, to favor the growers, to all of those things than to help out people who are, in essence, feeding this great nation. And that still goes on today, and it's a sad legacy that we have. What was important for me, again, and my overall arching goal was to capture this history, to document it, so that it could be remembered. We're 80, 90 miles from New York City, and the thought of this terrific treatment of workers of many different backgrounds for many years, as we bask in the affluence of even the county itself. Suffolk County was one of the, and still is one of the most wealthy counties in the nation. And right in the heart of New York City, which is one of the most wealthy in the nation. To see that treatment and have it almost gone forever was truly dire. And I was really blessed and pleased and took on the mantle to be able to capture this history and give it its rightful place in history.
I'm really grateful for your time. I really have enjoyed learning about it. And I really do appreciate you. Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day President Harry S. Truman signed Executive Order 9835. It is commonly referred to as the Loyalty Order. It required the screening of millions of federal civil servants and applicants. 9835 is considered one of the key preconditions for the rise of the McCarthyite Red Scare. It established a loyalty review board, a master index of those investigated, and definitions determining alleged disloyalty. Disloyalty could mean sedition, espionage, or advocating revolution. It could also mean membership or sympathetic association with movements considered totalitarian, fascist, communist, or subversive. Soon, the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations was published. It amounted to a blacklist. In their book, The 50s, Douglas Miller and Marion Nowak comment, between the launching of his security program in March of 1947 and December of 1952, some 6.6 million persons were investigated. Not a single case of espionage was uncovered, though about 500 persons were dismissed in dubious cases of questionable loyalty. All of this was conducted with secret evidence, secret and often paid informants, and neither judge nor jury. Despite the failure to find subversion, the broad scope of the official Red Hunt gave popular credence to the notion that government was riddled with spies. President Dwight Eisenhower would revoke 9835 with his executive order 10450. But this order dismantled the loyalty boards by transferring power to federal agencies. It also expanded investigations to include those engaged in immoral or disgraceful behavior. This included what is considered sexual deviance and led to the witch hunting and discrimination against gays and lesbians in civil service.
From the textile mills in Lawrence to the sweatshops in New York, from the fields in California where our children had to work, we fought to make a living.
Bread and roses was our cry.
Though they jailed and beat our bodies,
our spirits never died.
We were there.
That'll do it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Labor History in Two is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show, a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Our music today included the anthem of the ILGWU, sung by Joe Glazer. Sing Me a Song with Social Significance, sung by Rosemary June. And Bev Grant's We Were There. Her play will be performed this Wednesday night when the Coalition of Labor Union Women celebrates its 47th anniversary with an online performance of this play, which features inspiring women leaders from the past through the present, performed by women leaders of today. To register for this free show Wednesday at 7, go to dclabor.org and click on calendar. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.